This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's not been immune to a national rise in reported hate incidents on college campuses. A swastika burned into the ceiling of a Keene State College dorm, for example. And just before Thanksgiving, UNH President Huddleston said several students and staff had experienced harassment or threats. And so at universities around the state and at some high schools, educators are trying to open more dialogue about this. What hate speech really is, and what it isn't, what freedom of expression means, where the First Amendment comes in, and how to explore different viewpoints without shutting anyone down. We'll find out more this hour, and let's hear from you. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests for the hour. Joining us by phone is Reginald Wilburn. He's an associate professor of English at UNH who specializes in African-American literature and culture. And Professor Wilburn, it's great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Also joining us from Milford, Dave Alcox. He's a social studies teacher at Milford High School. In 2013, he was cited as a National Civics Teacher of the Year. And Dave Alcox, great to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be part of it.
Joining me in studio, John Grabe, professor of law at UNH, specializing in constitutional law and the First Amendment. And John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Dottie Morris, chief officer for diversity and multiculturalism at Keene State College. And Dottie, thanks for making the trip. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Well, Dottie, I want to start with you. What's hate speech? How do you define it?
Well, when I think of hate speech, I think of anything that is used in order to dehumanize or to cause harm to another person, either emotionally or psychologically. And this language is often, in my opinion, kind of the way that people are able to fix in their minds ways to think that the other person is less than who they are in order to carry out certain acts. So this whole idea of how does it inform my behavior? How does it incite me to act based on the way that I dehumanize someone? So I think about hate speech in that way, that any language that's used to dehumanize another person in order to carry out an act that you wouldn't normally carry out against a person that you think of as human. So it threatens the personhood.
So even if the act or the speech doesn't include a threat, you know, it's an insult,
right.
it's hateful language, even if it doesn't include a threat, and by the way, because I hate you, I'm going to do X to you, it's still hate speech.
In my mind, it still is, because I understand how that process works around the dehumanization process. And so even if I don't intend, the outcome can still be the same. So I may not intend to cause a threat, for example. So for a lot of us, certain words in and of themselves are kind of words that it can bring about a certain feeling as a result of how those words have been used in the past. So we could think about certain racial slurs, slurs against women, slurs against LGBTQ people, symbols that we customarily associate with danger. So because that association has been connected so clearly over the years, it's not surprising that just the sound of the word or just the sight of a symbol can elicit a certain kind of feeling of a threat or imminent danger in some way.
And then you can't focus on what you're supposed to do,
right,
because you're walking around,
right,
feeling like you need to look over your shoulder. And
right,
since you mentioned a symbol, I do have to ask you what your reaction was, Dottie, to that swastika at Keene State College. You know, the site of the a very honored Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies,
right,
of
right,
all places.
It was distressing, and it was distressing for everyone. And what we are trying to do now is create an environment where we could come together as a community to talk about what types of things do we want to have within our community that makes it growth producing for everyone. And so something like this could definitely have an impact on a large percentage of students feeling safe, feeling as though they are part of the community, feeling as though they are wanted within the community. And so part of what we want to do is to come together and have that discussion. But so, it was very disturbing to a lot of people on campus.
And John Graby, so is there a legal, constitutional definition of hate speech?
Well, you know, the First Amendment comes into play and limits the ability of public institutions to punish speech or expressive conduct. So the rules are different based on whether or not you're talking about a public college versus a public university versus a private college or university. There's also differences between the college setting and high school settings, for example. But there's no technical definition of hate speech. But what there is a series of cases that make clear that the government cannot regulate or punish speech or expressive conduct per se. It can punish trespass. It can punish intimidation, harassment, conduct that causes harm to victims. The problem is, of course, trying to sort out in those individual cases what's protected speech and where the line is, where somebody has gone beyond the line. And instead of just simply engaging in speech that many of us would find distasteful, has actually invaded the rights of others in a way that the college or university has an obligation to respond to.
Well, beyond distasteful, John, you know, feeling anxious, nervous, right, scared, you know, afraid to walk out of your house or your dorm room or whatever. I mean, is speech that incites those feelings in people protected?
It is. I mean, if it's – again, it can be. I mean, certainly protected speech can cause great distress. The First Amendment nonetheless protects that speech from being regulated or punished. If, however, somebody goes beyond the – now, for example, clearly the act of burning a swastika onto property, that can be punished. And the fact that it's motivated by a hateful impulse means that there can be extra punishment. But okay, that person, whoever did that, if that person were just simply expressing racist or anti-Semitic ideas or – you know, standing in a public spot holding up a swastika, that could not be punished by a public university. The First Amendment would protect that speaker's right to engage in that speech or expressive conduct.
If there's a threat implied, such as the letter some California mosques have received saying, I'm quoting, President Trump will cleanse America and he will do to you Muslims what Hitler did to the Jews. Is that a hate crime? Is it hate speech? Is it criminal threatening? I mean, I'm imagining people praying at those mosques that got that letter are feeling pretty scared.
Yeah, this too is a really tricky area of the law. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court decided that, yes, threats can be punished. Threats are not protected speech. But in order to punish somebody for a threat, that person needs to have intended what he or she said to be a threat. It's not enough that the recipient would understand it to be a threat. There rather needs to be a subjective intention to threaten somebody, or the First Amendment protects it.
Okay, and I want to get our other guests in too, but Dottie, I got to turn to you because she's shaking her head over here.
Oh, boy. Well, what I think is the whole idea of that kind of language can incite. Okay, so I know of a case that where the Ku Klux Klan was held accountable for language that they had used that incited a young man to act and murder someone. And so what I guess in my mind, I'm thinking, I can't even know my intent a lot of times. So how can I know the intent of another person? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's problematic because it's not just language, because I don't think that if it's an opinion, that's one thing. But language that's that fueled can really be problematic. And I think that we have that rub between the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment.
Well, that's
There's a constant rub between those two amendments.
That's right. That's right. The you know, the university also has an obligation to provide equality.
Yes.
It's a really, really complicated area of the law, and there are a lot of people who are dissatisfied about where the lines are drawn in the law.
Well, and Reggie, you're an English professor, and I know you've thought a lot about language and the words that are chosen and not chosen. How do you use this concern over hate speech, especially on campuses, colleges and high schools, as a teachable moment, Reggie, for your students?
Yeah. Well, as a teachable moment, and particularly in the humanities, you know, I really want my students to always think about their words have consequences. So for me, when we're talking about the difference between hate speech and free speech, sure, everyone is free to speak whatever they want to speak, in my opinion. But you also have the right to be critiqued, judged, right, and called out, right, on the level of the language, you know, that you use. And so for me in teaching, I always want to make sure that students understand why English matters, why language matters, because there are implied meanings, there are inferential meanings, there are literal meanings. And I think sometimes it's too easy to stop at the default of literal meaning and not think about the ways in which creative assaults can occur on implied and inferential levels of meaning and word usage.
What's a creative assault, Reggie?
So creative, and you know, I think when a person can make an utterance and mean a couple of different things, right? So this gets into the use of poetic language, metaphors, right, similes, right? So you can say one thing on one register where it clearly means this, but that there are other nuances, right? And so one may escape detection by what they really mean, or they can hide behind what they really mean because the literal meaning suggests this is what was meant.
I want to bring you into this too, Dave, and a little different for you. You're at the high school level. Everybody else here is working at the college level. How are your teenagers talking about this? You know, free speech, hate speech, what's okay, what isn't, you know, what's protected, what should be, what shouldn't be?
I think in what I've been hearing from the other panelists too is there's definitely a line between free speech and freedom of speech, and they're two separate issues. And obviously, a couple of the things they were talking about, you know, when you talk about incitement, you know, if you're going to create imminent lawless behavior, Brandenburg versus Ohio is a very famous Supreme Court case that identified, you know, it's one thing to say let's go burn down a mosque, but then it's another thing to say let's go burn down a mosque and here's how we should do it and here's when we should do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, one is actually creating an imminent lawless behavior versus just somebody who's just an angry person. Fighting words, the other one, like where can you say bad things? That's actually a New Hampshire case. That's Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire.
Yeah, I read about that. Yeah, comes from New Hampshire. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, in the 1950s, you know, a sheriff was called a GD fascist. And back in the 1950s, that was fighting words. And you know, so there are limitations to speech. I mean, there's time, place, and manner restrictions. There's clear and present danger restrictions. There's child pornography. Here in the high school setting, we use what we call the Tinker Standard, which comes from Tinker versus Des Moines back in the 60s, where John and Mary Beth Tinker and Chris Eckerd wanted to wear black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. They were told it was going to create what we call a material disruption. And in the high school setting, the concept of material disruption is the paramount issue on how we can regulate, you know, speech and expression. I mean, we use a case called Bethel versus Frazier in terms of sexual speech, but you know, the Tinker Standard is what we apply even today to expression. And if it's going to create what we call a material disruption, so if there's an expression in high school which is different than the college setting where the free flow or the marketplace of ideas are supposed to be rampant, at the school setting we use, like in loco parentis, where the principal is the local parent, and we also use captive audience doctrine where the kids have to be here, so therefore, like Abe Ford has said, you shouldn't shed your rights at the schoolhouse gate, but we also recognize they're limited as well.
Because they're children, so the standards are slightly different, even though, you know,
exactly,
some of the older teenagers don't look like children. They still are. So, you know, I have to ask you this, Dave, too, because, again, you're operating at the high school level. I was going through the Southern Poverty Law Center's report on K-12 and, you know, a rise in hate speech, you know, girls being, you know, called certain names, being grabbed,
exactly,
you know, Muslims, go home, Mexican students being told, you know, haha, your parents are going to get deported. Are you seeing any of this at Milford High School?
It's funny because I knew we were going to talk about this, and I talked to our administrators yesterday, and we had so little of an issue with this because of I think just the civility that our school, you know, kind of exudes. Our principal, Brad Craven, has been an amazing cultivator, if you would, of culture in our school. But I also have a ton of people on Facebook that are friends of mine, and I remember after the election, their first comments were, oh, my God, how are we going to teach about this election now that it's over with all the, you know, protests and going on? And it became a real contentious issue, I know, in a lot of other schools. I know we didn't have that issue here in Milford, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of places around the country where you really had to walk a fine line. I think the teachable moment, and I obviously don't want to continue talking because I want other people to be involved, but I think the teacher moment is the civility. You know, unfortunately, the kids in the last year and a half have seen a really contentious primary and general election, and what they consider to be, you know, decent behavior in terms of dialogue, what they've been seeing and what's been modeled for them has been absolutely atrocious. So unfortunately, they feel that because the adults are doing it, that needs to be the standard as well. And we really need to adjust that.
Well, and same question for you, Reggie, just getting away from this moment, this conversation about speech for a moment. Mm-hmm. You're an African-American man. You're teaching in a largely white university. Mm-hmm. What have you seen in terms of hate incidents or hate speech?
Not so much what I have seen, more stories that I have heard from students, a lot of students of color in particular, you know, incidents of being spat upon, incidents of, especially after the election, you know, random white students walking up to students of color and just saying, I voted for Trump. And so those types of dynamics, I'm aware of other stories of students being, you know, students of color being called different, you know, epithets, racial epithets. I have not witnessed those dynamics, but when I've heard about them, I've made sure to bring them into class because in my mind, in a literature course, literature as the humanities, everything is open. The world is open to be read and discussed as a text. So I really wanted students to be able to think about how to correlate what's going on in the real world alongside the very literature we're studying.
So again, you use that, you know, as that teachable moment, Reggie. I wonder, though, mm-hmm. like somebody who's going to sign up for an African-American literature and culture course probably mm-hmm. isn't the person making the hate speech. I wonder how you think the university can talk to everyone to say, you know, look, don't do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, again.
Reggie, did we lose you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Yes. So, of course, I'm speaking my own opinion, even though I'm employed here at UNH, but this is just my own personal opinion. I think that it's how all of us teach. I think it's how all of us interact in terms of teaching language, whatever field of study, language is being used, right, to entertain a particular discipline. So I think it's when all of us think about the ways in which the use of language can matter, has meaning, and can have consequences. And I think in the literature course in particular, I'm really interested in helping students to understand the nuances of words, because even among English majors, I believe it's possible that there are words that students use and are not necessarily aware of the nuances of the meaning of the words that they use. So I really want my students to be more discriminating users of the language, more discriminating interpreters of the language, the critical reading, because sometimes, getting back to my earlier idea around these creative verbal assaults, a nuanced reading of text to really understand, you know, a more subversive meaning that might be hidden up under the literal.
All right. After a short break. Yeah, Dave, I have to jump in. I'm so sorry. We got to go to a break, but we will pick up on that after a break. And let's hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the free speech debate as college campuses and some high schools grapple with a rise in hate speech. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number for your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests. Reginald Wilburn is with us, Associate Professor of English at UNH, specializing in African-American literature and culture, along with John Graby, Professor of Law at UNH, specializing in constitutional law. Dottie Morris is here, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism at Keene State College, and Dave Alcox, Social Studies teacher at Milford High School and a National Civics Teacher of the Year. And Dave, I know you wanted to jump back in just before the break, so go ahead there.
Well, what I was going to say was just to dovetail Reggie, because I think he's absolutely right about word choice. My psychology class yesterday, we had an amazing discussion. In the news lately, Donald Trump tweeting out, you know, people who burn the flag should either be lose their citizenship or go to jail and such. And our class had an amazing discussion about that yesterday, and mostly because of, you know, was it an act or was it a symbol? You know, and I think, you know, Reggie nails the point where people need to recognize, are there symbols that are heightened in our country? Just like are there words, like Dottie was saying earlier, are there words that are heightened in our society, which I think we can all agree upon as well. And I think the line is that the kids need to understand that, and there needs to be an open dialogue about appropriateness and you know, socioculturally, what's appropriate in our culture today versus, you know, 30 years ago.
Well, I got a comment from Dan on Facebook. It's a little long, Dan, so I won't read the whole thing, but thank you so much. Dan says, in the lead up to the Iraq War, as a UNH student, I was targeted and harassed by campus police for anti-war free speech activities because I dared challenge the absurd restrictions that the university placed on the posting of political signs on campus. Dan says political expression is supposed to be universally protected at public universities, but at this time at UNH, that protection had been eroded by a series of technicalities and regulations which reduced such expression to only being allowed in Orwellian free speech zones. Dan asks, what good is a supposed right to free speech if it is whittled down to near non-existence by administrative rules and regulations and the creation of these ridiculous free speech zones? Dan, thank you for the comment on Facebook. And John Graby, we have heard about this. You know, campuses are trying to make students feel safe, not threatened. On the other hand, you know, you do want a free exchange of ideas on campuses. Some have created these free speech zones. Others have created language codes. I mean, I just wonder what you think about all this.
Well, it's what Dan is getting at is, and David made reference to this earlier, the ability of public universities to impose what the law would call reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on speech. And so, you know, in a charged time, certainly the university needs to make available the opportunity for students and others to have their voices heard. But as long as they are not discriminating on the basis of the viewpoint or the content of the speech, the university is permitted to place limits on the time of speech, the place of speech, and the manner of speech. Now, sometimes those limits can be so great as to effectively deny people the right to speech. And it sounds as though that was how Dan experienced the limitations that UNH did then. The First Amendment, though, does permit some regulation of time, place, and manner. That said, you can go too far if you're not allowing for ample alternative channels for communication.
So there's Dan on Facebook feeling shut down. And a question for you, Dottie, and maybe you too, Dave. How do your schools deal with someone who, you know, expresses him or herself in a way that others don't like? It feels like a threat. Because some of the student dialogue that I've looked at, Dottie, you know, some students say, look, just punishing someone doesn't get to the root of the problem. Shutting down speech doesn't get to the root of the problem. It doesn't promote understanding. It doesn't promote human connection. How do you think universities and high schools should deal with this? I'll turn to you first, Dottie.
Okay. The whole idea of making everything a teachable moment, I think, is very important in the process. After people have created a situation where there's no imminent danger. So if there's an imminent danger related to the speech, then that has to be taken care of first. But in other cases, I think that making it a teachable moment, creating opportunities for students to learn about the impact, going back to something that was shared earlier, the impact of the language that they choose to use, that it might have on other people, to have conversations about, is this the type of community you would want to live in, by having people not feel as though they are a welcome part of it. And I think that oftentimes we are pretty quick to jump to conclusions that we know everything about the person based on one thing that they've said. And what I found with students that I've talked to, and part of that's part of what I do, is I talk to students who may have a difference of opinion. And when I talk to them, I find something really interesting, that oftentimes their difference of opinion isn't as far off as what I initially thought, because I think that oftentimes they might go to the extreme to say something because they haven't felt heard. And so part of how do we allow for students to find ways to express themselves where they don't have to go to such extreme means.
What do you think, Dave? What's the right way and what's the wrong way? You don't want to shut down dialogue.
No, you don't. But like at the college level, what you've run into is these free speech zones have actually been under fire, you could argue, literally, because there's a group called FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and they've been going after these free speech zones. And a lot of these universities have been settling out of court. I mean, there was a really famous issue out of Modesto where I think his name was Robert Van Totten was trying to pass out Constitution pocket constitutions on Constitution Day, and he got shut down because he didn't have approval 5 days before, like he was supposed to follow the free speech zone law, that their school had enacted. At the high school level, kids that have, alternative views, a lot of it really does come down to civic education. You know, like in the state of New Hampshire, we try to require a half year of civic education, for students, and part of that civic education is civil dialogue and civil discourse, and you need to recognize that, everybody does have the right, we're all different snowflakes, if you would, and so everybody thinks a little differently, but you need to share and recognize, what those ideas are, and there needs to obviously be a level of respect for those ideas, but also, certain ideas that our society finds unacceptable or not tolerable, there needs to be that education of why it's unacceptable and not tolerable. I mean, I deal with kids all the time who some of their trains of thought, you sit there and you say, wow, that normal is a lot different than a lot of other people's normal. And, you have to really have tolerance and understanding and recognize. And at least if they see that, maybe that opens up a chain or a dialogue with them as well.
Reggie, again, you're someone who deeply loves the English language. What do you think about these free speech zones that Dan writes about?
Well, I'm in favor of them because I think too often what happens in our daily thought is that freedom and free speech is equated to license. And I think that free speech does not necessarily mean license, especially because citizenship comes with a great responsibility. So if the words that I use, right, if they demean, if they dehumanize, if they put you down at the expense of my being puffed up, I think that's an ethical and a moral reflection of the character of the speaker. And so for me, I'm interested in tracking the language of a given speaker, right, as an autobiographical reflection of who they are in that moment, right? And so I think the more when we leave it on the plane of free speech, hate speech, I think it ignores the speaker. And I think in the humanities, I think this is the prime moment, right, to really begin thinking about how do individuals in a society coexist with one another, right? And it's through language, right? And so that importance of thinking about the moral and ethical responsibility behind the words that we use, I think when we put the spotlight on that, right now, the personal and the individual becomes political in a whole new register because now you have to be accountable for the words that you use.
So this is, sorry we keep coming back to this teachable moment, but this is almost a good moment, Reggie, for mm-hmm. professors of English and history because these mm-hmm. these are the texts that help us figure this all out.
Yes. Well, and not just the humanities, but the social sciences as well, right? Because I think at the end of the day, we're talking about people, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about individuals. I really loved Dottie's phrase earlier, growth potential. I think if we can use the humanities and the social sciences as a platform for helping students to become, to cultivate an openness for growth potential. That is, I may not be racist, but I can see how the language that I use in this given moment may not be the most appropriate choice, word choice. And because I am a citizen who means no harm, I'm open to growing. Right. And so I think the humanities and the social sciences can play a role in that dynamic.
Well, again, Dan, thanks for the Facebook comment. John Graber, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I just wanted to say that, yeah, I mean, the, this idea is actually reflected in constitutional doctrine as well. In support of the idea that outside of circumstances where we're talking about direct harassment or threats or intimidation or vandalism or something like that, that outside of those contexts, speech cannot be stopped and speech cannot be punished, however hateful it may be. The court says the way to remedy hateful speech is with more speech and with counter speech.
Well, that's what the ACLU says. I was looking mm-hmm. at this yesterday.
Right.
So go ahead, John.
You know, so and that's really embedded in our in our foundational First Amendment cases. This idea of a marketplace of ideas, and that hateful speech will trigger responsive speech that ought to be more persuasive and provide opportunities for growth and learning.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Here's a email that came in from Bill in Plymouth. He says, to what degree are Black Lives Matter calls for the killing of police and general mayhem in the name of equality hate speech? Bill, thank you so much. And Dottie, do you want to address that?
I don't recall in anything that I've read Black Lives Matter calling for the death of police officers or any of that other kind of thing that was alluded to in the email. I just don't know of that. And in my mind, if that is the case, then I would be concerned about that type of language as well, because to me that would be one of those situations that could potentially incite a violent act. But since, to my knowledge, it isn't true, I think that we have to look at how certain people can oftentimes reinterpret the meaning of something that someone has put out there. And I think that when we look at some of the things that Black Lives Matter is involved in, it, you could see how people could twist it to imply or that that's what they're saying. But I've never in any of the literature, in working with some of the, especially young people who are involved in Black Lives Matter, I've never heard that as even being even remotely discussed. So I think that we even have to talk about how certain groups are perceived in order to understand how other groups interpret their behavior.
Here's another. Thank you for that email, Bill. Here's another email from Robin. I would like to hear your guests' views as to why the degree and volume of hateful speech has become so pronounced. Robin asks, what's driving it? I'm going to throw that to the civics teacher, I think. Go ahead, Dave.
I would love to jump in on that one. And part of it, I think, is sociocultural, where in our culture today, we have so much social media going on. I mean, you know, if you look at any of these protests, no matter what protest you name, everybody and their brother has their camera out and they're recording, and everybody and their brother is trying to get a rise. And, you know, there was an article called The Washington Kodak Moment that I gave out to my students about a month ago, and, you know, the author was like, you know, climb the mountain to see the mountain, not so that everybody can see you. And what I think we're running into is, you know, everybody and their brother wants their shock moment, and so sometimes, you know, the things that they're posting on social media is trying to get a rise, and they think it's funny, and it's just a level of education that they don't realize that what they're saying and doing is can be extremely hateful, and that's part, and again, that's just lack of education and a certain level of ignorance that people aren't you know, sharing you know, their ideas and thoughts with each other. They're just trying to you know, make a statement that it's almost like shock therapy, if you would.
Mm, and it's free in a way because, you know, it's you're not saying it to somebody's face.
Exactly.
So it percolates, Dave, on social media. And then sounds like now, though, people are saying it to people's faces or scrawling it on walls or holding up signs at rallies and so forth that would feel threatening to others, you know, whether that's...
Exactly. The lines have gotten blurred.
I see. Okay. Reggie, your thoughts on Robin's question? Robin, thank you so much.
Oh, well...
He sighs.
This is my personal opinion. I believe that Donald Trump's campaign has certainly tapped into, in my view, right, something that had been percolating for a while. I think it has been celebrated. We could not ignore it. And so I think it made possible, right, a certain unleashing of anxiety by certain types of individuals. And so for me, it's like a way of trumping reality, pun intended, where reality TV, right, the whole celebrity culture of reality TV, you're fired, right? And you put that within the context of, you know, a primary campaign, a presidential campaign, right? You're tapping into the realities of certain people's existences and experiences of feeling left behind, you know, and sort of playing on certain racial, gender, you know, marginalized perspectives and those dynamics and fears and frenzies. I think this is the outlash of that and the outbreak of that, right? This continuing of trumping reality because reality can be trumped.
What do you think, Reggie, about what Dave said, that this was kind of percolating for a long time and that it's, you know, exacerbated by that desire, like the way Dave put it, sort of their shock moment, and you do it online for a while, and then maybe you can go out in the public and do it. I mean, what if you think that this has been amplified by sort of broader cultural forces?
I believe that is certainly playing itself out as well. I think I keep thinking about Elizabeth Alexander's inaugural poem, A Praise Song for the Day, right? And I won't get the quote exactly right, but the ending of the poem is something like praise song for walking forward in the light, in that light, right? Where that light is supposed to, we were supposed to be heading into this new dispensation, right? Having an elected and a president that perhaps many of us never thought we'd live to see. And I think when we look at these last 8 years, I think there has just been a growing anxiety with what that new dispensation looks like and how it was playing out. And so I certainly think these different cultural, sociocultural forces are playing out alongside that reality.
The reality of, yeah, communication and so
yes.
forth.
Well,
and bunch of emails that I want to share with you after a break in just a moment. I want to encourage you to call, too. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Just since President-elect Trump came up, I did want to mention that in a 60 Minutes interview in mid-November, President-elect Trump was asked about these incidents directly, and he said he was surprised to hear it. He hates to hear it. He was saddened to hear it. And he said, stop it. So he said, if that's help, I will say this. And I'll say it right to the camera. Stop it. So I just wanted to put that out there as well. Lots more emails, lots more of your calls, questions in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Granite State educators tackle issues of free speech, hate speech, the First Amendment. Give us a call. We'd love your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns. How do you define hate speech? What do you think about this reported increase in hate incidents or hate speech at schools and universities around the country? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, also at NHPR Exchange. And John Graby, just quickly to you before we go to our callers, a couple speakers, Reggie and Dave, talked about social media and, you know, encouraging people to get that sort of shock moment or something that gets a lot of likes or whatever, and that's having an impact on how free people feel to say things that might cause anxiety in others. I wonder what you've observed as a person who's watched the First Amendment.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and this is me stepping a little bit out of my role as a constitutional law professor. But, I mean, I do think there's just been a real coarsening, and there have been there's so many more opportunities now for people to weigh in. I remember when I was in college, I remember the Morton Downey Jr. show, seeing that for the first time, and this a talk show where a host would yell at the audience and was walking around sort of aggressively smoking. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, and now if you saw that on cable, you wouldn't even pause. You'd say, oh, of course, you know, I'm just, you know, flipping through cable channels. And, you know, and social media is really complex. The courts haven't yet really dealt with it very much. The first case that went to the Supreme Court involving social media was this True Threat case from a couple of years ago, where a guy wrote rap lyrics and posted rap lyrics on Facebook that were perceived to be threatening. And he was arrested for threatening his ex-wife. And the Supreme Court said that he couldn't be convicted of threatening behavior simply because she took it as a threat. Rather, he had to have subjectively intended it as a threat. And they vacated his conviction. So
but she's walking around feeling like he's going to pop up, you know, around some corner and who knows what. So,
that's right.
But just because it was language.
Yeah, just because this is how the Supreme Court interprets the First Amendment, it's a separate question whether it's a proper interpretation or not, but they interpret it as not permitting us to punish somebody for threatening unless the person subjectively intended to threaten. It's not enough that people received it as a threat.
So here's an email from Michael who talks about this issue. So Michael says, I take some issue with the professor's opinion that every word or sentence should be subject to rigorous examination of subversive subtext. People apply meaning to words through their own lens and can find hate in almost anything, even if the author didn't intend it. UNH, Michael says, especially should be cautious of limiting speech because of its potential of being offensive, given recent blowback on its banned microaggressions. Language should have an impact on the listeners. If not, why speak? So, Reggie, I want to hear from you on this, but you first, John, please. So, Michael's expressing something that, yeah, sometimes people do say, okay, some people are super sensitive. They could see a threat in anything when I might say, no, I didn't mean it that way. So there's a continuum of the woman whose ex-husband, you know, made very scary comments on Facebook and someone who says something offhandedly and says, no, my goodness, I didn't mean it that way. I wonder what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael's view on this is one that a majority of the Supreme Court shares. I think that the concern there, they've drawn the balance in favor of avoiding prosecuting people who were merely speaking and did not subjectively intend to threaten or do harm. And in order to reach that ruling, they had to subordinate the interest of protecting people who are experiencing that speech as threatening.
You know, to some degree, when I hear that, it's almost like we invalidate the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment trumps the 14th Amendment.
And the 14th, remind us, Dottie.
Equal protection under
equal
the
protection.
Law.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that many people who would criticize where the line has been drawn would share that view, that we are undervaluing the equality mandate and overvaluing the free speech protection.
Okay.
Reggie, do you want to jump in on Michael's email?
Yeah.
And Michael, thank you very much.
Yeah, I would just go back and reiterate my point. I don't believe language, free speech means license. I think we have to be very concerned about the words that we use. And so when I'm talking about deconstructing language, I'm not talking about deconstructing it where everything means whatever the interpreter means. Like, I think that's a real loosey-goosey approach to language. I'm thinking about the role of citizenship in the use of language, you know, and this is the way that I operate, even when I don't mean to hurt someone's feelings. If there's something that I do, if you tell me I have offended you, I'm going to at least sit back and be reflective. And maybe that wasn't the best word. Maybe that's an opportunity for me to clarify. It's also an opportunity for me to understand without judging who you are. And I guess I want a society that sort of takes a second thought. You know, well, maybe that wasn't the best use of the word, of the language. Maybe I could have used something else. That's not what I meant. Or maybe that is what I meant. And now I see, my folly has been exposed. So for me, I don't think that we want to get into the loosey-goosey nature of language, but at the same time, we do live in a world that is bound by language. Constitutional law is exacting on purpose by design. When you sign a contract, that language needs to be very specific, and yet somehow it seems that certain people wish to just use language willy-nilly without the consequences and accountability, and that's what I'm against. That's what I would like us to become more sensitive about, is how words do matter in a variety of contexts.
Well, and Michael, thank you for your email. And let's go to Anna on the phone from Salem. Hi, Anna. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, Anna. You're on the air.
Sorry, I'm in Enfield, if it makes a difference.
Oh, okay. Well, that threw you then. I apologize.
Okay. I wanted to ask the panel and you just about, you were talking about the concept of a teachable moment. And I'm wondering if that doesn't do too much to shift the onus of responsibility onto the person who's experienced the hate speech, and if it's not a type of victim blaming to expect. That pretty much sums it up.
So, Anna, so the victim shouldn't have to have so many teachable moments? Is that what you're saying? That?
Well, yeah, when you say teachable moment, I'm wondering who's doing the teaching. And it's analogous to rape culture to me to expect the victim of the experience to do the teaching.
You know, Anna, thank you so much. And Dottie, to you, I love your thoughts here. You also, earlier in the show, talked about moments where you had sat down with students who had said things that had really upset other students. And can you shed a little light on those dialogues?
And I really do understand, Anna, what you're saying in spirit, the whole idea that if I'm the victim, I'm supposed to have a certain type of understanding for you as the perpetrator. So I totally get that piece. The teachable moment for me is related to an institution's responsibility to provide that moment. So that's why I said that I don't expect the student who has been, harmed by speech to do the educational piece. That's part of what I do as a representative of the institution, to have the student think a lot further than what they initially thought when they engaged in the behavior that they engaged in that was harmful to the other person. So I totally hear what you're saying, and that's not what I expect. I don't expect the person who has been harmed to do the teaching. I expect institutions to take responsibility to support the victim in so many ways by taking on that task.
And if I could,
sure, Dave, go ahead.
I call it the firehouse effect. You can't send the fire truck out unless there's a fire.
That's it.
So generally, there has to be an issue that happens to use as the teachable moment.
Right.
You know what I mean? You can't just pull them out of the midair. So generally, something has to happen to be addressed. And, you certainly don't point the finger at the victim, but you use that moment as the teachable moment and say, look, this is obviously what happened. Let's discuss this. And that opens the dialogue.
All right, let's take another call. Thank you, Anna, for that one. Alex joins us from Rochester. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an experience that really kind of opened my eyes to, the problem of the looseness of the interpretation of a threat and of free speech and whether that's protected or not. In regards to a local business owner, I won't mention the name of the business or the type of business, just that it's located in my downtown Rochester area. And I had a good standing relationship with this business for over 10 years, no problems at all, until one day I disclosed to this business owner that I have a disability in the form of a mental illness. And not long afterwards, I received a threat from this person via email and personal put-downs with profanity and insults. And I reported this to my local police department, and they kindly met with me in person. The officer met with me in person and brought out like a New Hampshire RSA rule book and pointed out how specifically what this business owner said did not specifically fit into the very specific category of a threat.
So sounds like, John, it was an insult and a bad insult. And Alex, I'm so sorry that happened to you, but not a threat.
Well, it sounds like that's how the police construed it. It's a very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult to turn these incidents, which are just inevitable as we live our lives, into occasions for legal action. There are certainly cases where there's absolutely no doubt that a line has been crossed and that it's appropriate to punish, that we're in the context of conduct. But there are all sorts of situations that are murky, and the law is very murky.
Sounds like more situations are murky if we're going to be strictly legal about it, John, just listening to you for the past hour.
Yeah, just – I mean, given the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment in this area, there is no clear path forward. There are just judgments that need to be made.
Well, here's a question from Joey in Manchester. Joey says, we always say that someone cannot yell fire in a crowded movie theater despite what their personal intent would be. Likely a prank, Joey says, not intended to cause mass chaos. He says the intent isn't the issue in the movie theater. The issue is what it causes. He asks, why do we not apply the same thinking to someone using speech that affects others, causes anxiety or fear or worse? So let's go to you first, Reggie, but maybe you too, Dave. What do you think, Reggie?
I echo those sentiments wholeheartedly. When I deal with individuals who offend me on any, you know, for whatever reason, I make it a point to emphasize that I'm not dealing with the intention. I can never know your intention. I'm dealing with the impact, right? The effect of what you said or what you did.
That you feel nervous or scared now.
Right, because of something you did. And so, again, that puts the onus back on the individual, right? Where, again, the word usage is an autobiographical reflection of who they are, right, in that moment, for good, for bad, or for indifferent. But it's never about the intention for me, because I can never know the intention. If I stayed and dwelled in intention, that would be its own rat race, right, for me mentally. I find it more productive to deal with the impact, because my feelings, they are real for me, right, and I have to deal with that.
So, and we got this from another emailer earlier, Reggie. So, you know, if the feelings that emerge from whatever insult or words you face is anxiety, you're afraid to go out, you're afraid somebody's going to, you know, jump on you. But then we've heard from other people who say, look, everybody's overly sensitive these days. And, you know, how far do we take this? So I just wonder what you think about that, Reggie.
Yeah, well, I think what's interesting when we're talking about, you know, threats, or when we're talking about, well, when someone feels a certain way, I think it becomes into a certain type of positionality politics comes into play. When you can own and recognize that you have a certain privilege over another individual that you may interact with. In my world, I think that that should make you humble when someone from a group, a marginalized group, approaches you and says, hey, you know, you said so-and-so, this is what I felt, right? As a male, right, if there's something that I do and a woman feels that it's insensitive or that it was, you know, whatever, you know, I'm not going to say, well, you know my spirit, you know my heart, da-da-da-da-da. I'm going to sit on that because I'm aware that I have been grown up, socialized into a patriarchal culture, right? I may not, and I don't expect that I'll always get it right. And so I always want to be reflective, even when I feel my intention was well intended. If my words have a matter, if they resonate for someone in a particular way, I at the very least want to be reflective around, well, maybe I could have done that and said that differently.
You know, Dave, what do you think about Joey's example? And Joey, well, thanks again for the email. Yeah, go ahead. You know,
Claire, the fire in a crowded movie house, that's Oliver Wendell Holmes. And that was in 1919 in Schenck versus U.S. and Abrams versus U.S. when they were protesting the Espionage Act of 1916. And I think, you know, I absolutely agree with Reggie. In fact, all the panels, Dottie and John, I'm going to probably use a lot of your thoughts today in my class, so thank you very much for my for my next day's classes. But you know, I think that with the, you know, fire in a crowded movie house, that was geared more. I think what the court was looking at was, you know, that goes after that goes after public safety, where, you know, what Reggie was talking about, marginalized groups, he nailed it right on the head. You know, your thoughts that you're saying in terms of hate speech is much different than public danger. And I understand what you're saying, Laura, about like, where do you draw the line? Because then everybody can be in danger. You know, but with you know, can't yell, you know, not being able to yell fire in a crowded movie house was geared towards more of a public safety and you know, issue versus, you know, here you're expressing a viewpoint that could marginalize, that could discriminate, that could lead to, you know, imminent lawless behavior. So I see what the author, the, the individual who called in was saying, but there is a division there, you know.
Well, last question, and Dottie, I'll throw it to you. So what do you do next? I mean, here you are in this position at Keene State College, you know, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism. What do you do?
Well, I feel very, very honored, and I feel like I'm in a great position at Keene State by having a wide range of people who are very interested in participating in having discussions about where do we go from here to create the community that we all want to live in. So definitely being led by the Holocaust and Genocide
Center.
Thank you. Some words are harder than others. Being led by that group, but other faculty and staff and students are coming forward to say, we need to figure this out. Because one thing we don't want to do is to turn on each other. And we want to continue to grow and have a community that we're all proud of.
Well, I really want to thank everybody who chimed in today, too. Lots of comments, email, Facebook, tweets, and so forth, and phone calls. And Doug from Durham said, I'd like to note in some ways your panel is skirting around the heart of the issue, which is many universities are not simply confronting hate speech with more speech, but actually limiting speech. Doug says teachable moments often entail real consequences for students whose speech is deemed unacceptable. Speech most would consider legally permissible. Here's a tweet from Ray, who shares a Facebook post from Rabbi Dana Rutenberg. She put a note in her 7-year-old's lunchbox. It says, my dear boy, today find a kid who looks lonely and invite them to play with you. So thank you, Ray, for that tweet. Dave, John, Dottie, Reggie, thank you so much for all being here. Really appreciate it. This
thank
is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.